Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Hi, this is Bill, and welcome to this week's episode of Real... Hi, this is your host, Bill, and welcome to this very special episode of Real World Fitness. What makes today so special? Very simple. It's my birthday, and I'm in a mood to celebrate. And yeah, that sounds a little self-indulgent, maybe a little childish to some of you. Yeah, you know, you're 55 years old, and actually I'm 56 today, provided you're actually listening to this on my birthday. But I believe in celebrating things. I believe in making a big deal out of little things that are positive. Too many people make a big deal out of the little negative things. I mean, the world is coming to an end, I missed my show, or my dinner's a little overcooked, or... You know, people just make such a huge deal over garbage that I really think they should put equal thought into making a big deal over good things that happen. Celebrate your days. Celebrate your anniversary. Celebrate your birthdays. Celebrate the fact that it's Tuesday and you got up and the sun is shining and you feel good. Be a little self-indulgent now and then. It makes you a better person for the rest of the world. And in that vein of self-indulgence, that's what our interview is about today, actually. I recorded this interview several months ago and wanted to save it for a special occasion and decided it was going to be my birthday show. This interview is with a gentleman named Bill Pearl, who is Mr. America and multiple-time Mr. Universe winner and one of my personal bodybuilding and fitness heroes. He's considered a legend in the industry and has received more awards and more honors than I have time to list here. They'll be listed in the show notes. He's also a really classy, intelligent, articulate gentleman. And I had a lot of fun interviewing him. And I hope he's listening because I want to say it was an honor to have the opportunity to speak with him, considering he hasn't granted anyone an interview in about 10 years. And I also want to take this moment to thank our mutual friend, Mr. Olympia, Chris Dickerson, for making the interview possible. Now, I'd like to ask everybody out there to give me a little birthday present. I'd like you all to take a moment and go to Facebook, those of you that are regular Facebook visitors, and go to my page, Kosiaba Fitness, and like the page. I'd really appreciate it if you'd just take a moment and like that for me. And now before we get to the interview, we need to plug the sponsor, audible.com. You need to go to audiblepodcast.com/Serotalk and sign up for a free trial membership, free 30-day trial. And with that, you get to download any book on the site. And there are thousands upon thousands. I think I read the number 180,000 books. Not to mention old radio shows and all kinds of other really cool stuff. I've been using the site for the last several months and have downloaded several books and really enjoyed them. Enjoyed the fact that I had different options. The Mick Jagger book I was reading a couple weeks back that I mentioned, there's two different versions of it with two different people narrating. Same book, just two different narrators. So you get the choice of which one sounds better. And I noticed in just skimming around, a lot of the classics are recorded multiple times with multiple narrators, and some of them actually are performed with more than one person narrating them, which makes them kind of cool. So check it out. That's audiblepodcast.com/Serotalk. And now to my interview with Mr. America, Mr. USA, Mr. Universe, Bill Pearl. In the world of entertainment and the world of sports, you hear the word legend thrown around very easily. I guess anyone that's been around for a long time, they call him a legend. Now, my guest today is, by anybody's standards, truly a legend of bodybuilding, a legend of physical culture, and what would be considered one of the pioneers of modern-day bodybuilding. He had a competitive career that ran for 18, 19 years. And after he won the Mr. California, he was undefeated throughout his career. And after he stopped competing, he started training other people and has more Mr. America, Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympia winners that will give him credit publicly for his support than anyone else. It's a tremendous pleasure to introduce my guest today, Bill Pearl.
Thank you, Bill. What a fine introduction. This is terrific. Thank you.
Well, every word of it is true.
Well, that's very nice of you.
Well, let's start where everybody always wants to start. How did you get started in bodybuilding weight training?
I was about 11 years old, and I have an older brother who's 3 years older than I. And every day like clockwork, I know my brother is going to make me cry. So it's the old sand kicked in your face, the old Charles Atlas syndrome. I suffered from that.
Okay, but it wasn't the bully on the beach taking your girlfriend. It was your big brother.
That's exactly right. He was just taking it out on me, not my girlfriend, just on me, myself. I mean, I got tired of it. So I said, this is enough. So I made up my mind I'm going to get bigger, stronger, so I could defend myself against my brother.
And if I remember reading correctly, your earliest weight training equipment was kind of unique.
Yes, I saved about maybe 3 or 4 months. I bought a York Big Ten Special. I think it cost $22.95. And I ordered it in 1942, and I got delivery in 1945. So it took them 3 years to get me the set. But it was during World War II, and things were slow. But once I got the set, I knew, Bill, when that set was in my basement, that was my college education, everything else I wanted to do in my life, right there, sitting in that box.
Well, that shows a tremendous change in the world. You accepted and waited for the 3 years, and the way the world is today, if it isn't here in 3 days, people would be complaining.
This is true.
Actually, what I was going for was before that York set, when your parents had the restaurant, didn't you have some
before I was able to buy this set, I was about 11-year-old kid. No, I guess it must have been about 13, I guess, when this happened. Well, 42, I was 12. But my mother and dad owned restaurants. And when I was a 9 or 10-year-old kid, I do exercises in the backyard or when I was washing dishes and lifting cans of fruit and whatever it may be and sacks of potatoes and stuff because I didn't have a barbell set. So I used things I could find in my dad's restaurant in the back where we stored everything to train on, Bill. And I did push-ups and chin-ups on pipes and everything I could possibly do to make myself bigger and stronger.
So you got very creative.
Well, I had to, Bill, because that's all I had to work with.
Well, you can get a better workout with that stuff than you probably could with $100,000 worth of Nautilus machines.
Well, with the attitude that I had, I'm sure that you're right.
Okay, so you started lifting in 1945 with real weights, and what kind of an athlete were you in school, high school?
I was a good athlete, Bill, but I had to work at it. Nothing has come easy, Bill. I mean, I was a good in track. I was good in football and baseball, whatever I attempted to do, but I didn't come easy. I had to work at it harder than most people do to do what I did, but I ended up on first string on everything that I had done, but I had to work at it harder than others.
What was your sport?
I like track. I like football. I was a wrestler. I was a Navy champion in wrestling for several years. Oh, the 3 or 4 years I was in the Navy, and I tried off the United States Olympic team in 1952, so I had a good run in amateur wrestling.
Wow. Okay, that I didn't know. So you were started out as a multi-sport guy, but it was wrestling for you.
It was wrestling, and I knew that my weight training, I probably did as well in wrestling as I did because of my weight training, Bill, because I was stronger than most of these guys.
Sure. Back then, coaches wouldn't encourage weight training to supplement a sport.
This is true.
So how did you get from wrestling to, I'd like to enter a bodybuilding show?
Well, my desire was to, I used to take an old Strength and Health magazine. I'd buy it in a drugstore. I'd put it in my back pocket or hide it so no one could see what I had. And I'd take it home and look at everything. And they had an up-and-coming champion type of a, I don't remember the name of the title they had for this one thing, but like a kind of a before and after photograph of people. And my goal was to get my picture in that Strength and Health magazine. So I trained for years hoping that someday I could find myself in the magazine. And I joined the Navy in 1950, and I trained at Whidbey Island Naval Air Station in Whidbey Island, Washington, for 2 years at the recreational camp that I was there. Then I got stationed in San Diego and joined Leo Stern's gym. And that's where everything popped from there on in.
Ah, and that was the beginning of a very long relationship with you and Leo.
Yes.
Did he see the potential in you, and did he say, kid, I'm going to make you a champion, or?
He didn't talk like that. I mean, but he was the type of guy that every time I'd ask him a question, his first answer would be no. But then he'd put a but, if you do it this way, you're going to be okay. And I trusted Leo so much that anything he told me to do, I did.
Same kind of relationship you and Chris had.
Exactly the same thing. Chris Dickerson, yes.
Yes. Ah. So, and then you paid it forward by pretty much doing the same thing for Chris.
Well, yes, and then, but Chris was a different, he was probably the best student I've ever had. He never questioned anything I suggested that he do, and he had so much faith in me, what I told him to do, he was going to work regardless if it was wrong. With Chris, it would have worked right.
It was going to work just because he believed that strongly.
That's exactly right, yes.
Well, to accomplish everything he's accomplished, and still, I can't have a conversation without Chris without hearing my friend Bill Pearl, my coach Bill Pearl, my trainer Bill Pearl.
He was very nice. He's always done that. He's paid me back 1,000 times over in his own way. If there was ever an interview that could lead to anything that he had done, he always included me, Bill, always.
Well, it's not just in interviews in public. I mean, just in private conversations where he and I've been chatting, he's very quick to, you know, give you credit for everything that has been good in his life.
Well, we're good friends. He's like part of the family, Bill.
Good guy. So what was the first contest you competed in?
The Mr. San Diego contest, 1952. I placed third, and I was stationed aboard a big submarine tender in the bay, and I can remember going to the ship on a bus and showing everybody on the ship, on the bus on my way to the ship, the trophy that I had won in this contest. I was as proud as you could possibly be. I thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life.
Well, up to that point, it probably was.
Well, it was. And then the following year, and that was 1952, and then in the following year, I won the Mr. Oceanside, Mr. San Diego. No, I didn't win in Mr. San Diego. The Mr. Oceanside, Southern California, Mr. California, Mr. America, and then Mr. Universe title the following year.
That was a busy year for you.
Very busy.
Wow.
I didn't have a clue what I was doing, Bill. Not a clue.
Well, that's why you had Leo by your side.
That's for sure.
And then you went into the gym business shortly thereafter.
I was discharged in 1954, and I opened a health club in Sacramento, California, and that's where my career in the gym business began. And that lasted until about 1972.
See, now that right there brings a question to my mind. You lasted in one of the hardest industries there is for 18 years. I lasted in the business for 17 years. Everybody that ever picked up a barbell probably dreamed of owning their own gym. And I've seen far more fail than succeed. What do you attribute the longevity in the gym business to? What was your key to success?
I separated myself from the gym. I got up early and trained every morning. I took care of myself before I took care of everybody else. But the gym was a business. And I never talked about my own training and everything else, even though I did work out, Bill, my time and went to my customer. But I started every day that I was in the gym business with myself for a couple hours before I gave the rest of the world what I had left over to give.
And that's smart, because if you don't take care of yourself, you're not at your best and you can't give to the rest of the world.
This is true.
Why the long gap between 53 and 56, the long competition gap?
I never competed against people, Bill. I competed against myself. And so I didn't want to compete against the same guys year after year after year. I'd wait till a new crop would come along. And when there's new guys on the field that were making an impact, I thought I'd compete myself against them rather than the people I'd already won the contest from.
Yeah, I suppose it would get boring seeing the same three or four guys all the time.
Well, not necessarily that, but I looked at it as if it were a job, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
It was never fun for me on stage. I've never really had fun on stage. I looked at it as if it were a job, and it was part of my job to succeed in the gym business, what I was attempting to do. It was like a report card, Bill.
Sure. Every time you stepped on stage and won another award, it was adding to your credibility.
That's right.
I'm going to go off in another direction, going back to, since you were such a good amateur wrestler, and since you were obviously a big guy, and a lot of other people in bodybuilding have gone in this route, did you ever give any thought to going into pro wrestling?
I did, but I was so busy with my the gym business, and I married and I had three kids, and I just couldn't afford to do that, Bill. I, I had obligations I had to take care of. I just couldn't afford to take the chance to get out there. And most of those guys got paid on a percentage of the gate that came through the door, Bill. And I couldn't afford to do that. I had to have an income that I could count on.
That's everything you're saying so far shows so much stability and so much responsibility for what was a young kid, 23, 25 years old at that time. You had your head on your shoulders real right.
Well, I just feel that I had obligations I had to take care of, and I want to be successful, Bill. I want to be successful. I didn't do well in school. I was 4 months shy of 20 getting out of high school, so I wasn't a brain by any means, but if I put myself to something, I'd be okay.
Okay. Well, you were, maybe you weren't a brain in textbooks, but you sure had some sense to you and incredible responsibility, whether you got that from your parents or you dug that up somewhere else, I don't know. But your work ethic and your level of responsibility is to be commended.
Well, thank you.
And 71 was your final competition, the Mr. Universe in 71. How was your preparation different at 41 than it was at 22 or 25, getting ready for a show?
Okay, well, I was dealing with kids. Arnold Schwarzenegger was a hot dog at the time, and he was 17 years younger than I. And Frank's name is going to be in the contest, and so I knew that I was pushing my luck, Bill, to even think about getting in the contest at that age, because it was pretty rare for a person at 41 years old to compete in a contest when that was the best that there was out there. When the Mr. Universe contest at time was like the Mr. Olympia contest or higher, that's the best that you could possibly do. And what I did, I took a photograph of Schwarzenegger and I put it on my mirror in the bathroom about a year before the contest. The best photograph I could find of him and the worst photograph I could find of myself next to him. I said, I've got to go from that to beat this. And that was my drive every day when I shaved myself. I was looking in that mirror, looking at Schwarzenegger.
So I gather
before the contest, after he had challenged all of us to the contest, he bagged out and didn't compete.
So I bet, I'm going to guess that was a huge disappointment to you.
To me? I have to laugh, Bill. It wasn't, because I won the contest. If he had been there, perhaps I would not have won. But with him not there, I beat the guys like Sergio Oliva, Frank Zane, Reg Park. The best that was in the world was there, other than he. And I won, so I was satisfied. I can't say that I was disappointed that he was there, wasn't there, because I wasn't. That was his choice, not mine.
Okay. Now, I guess the question would be, if there's anybody that you never stood on stage against that you would like to, I suppose the answer would be him.
No, that's not true at all. I mean, when I won the Mr. Universe contest in 1967, I won the professional, he won the amateur. And so I had a good run, and he was on stage in the... But I didn't feel that I had to compete against him or anybody else, Bill. I was competing against myself.
Okay. Now, since you mentioned the Mr. Olympia, I'm curious, why is it you never took a run at the Mr. Olympia title?
It wasn't a title that was worth even having when I was competing in 1970, 71. And up until those times, the contest was so poorly run and so few contestants, it wasn't worth your time to go to it.
Okay.
There would be two or three people entered, and how many contests, Mr. Olympia contests did Schwarzenegger win? But he was on stage with maybe one other person or two other people, and that was it, period.
I think he actually was unchallenged 1 year, just like Sergio 1 year just showed up and they handed him the check.
Well, why bother? I mean, why win something such as that when there's no competition whatsoever? It was a waste of time.
Sure, absolutely. And then when you went to London, you had people from all over the world you were competing against.
I had 50-some people, 52 people in my class when I won my last Mr. Universe contest from all over the world, yes.
That has to play a significant role in determining which was a more important title at that point.
No question.
Okay, you obviously were hugely successful, won everything that you wanted to win. Was there a reason that you did not have a relationship with the Weeders?
Well, I had a relationship with Joe and Ben. I was the chief judge, or the head judge of the IFBB for 7 or 8 years. All the physique contests that were professional physique contests held throughout the United States and around the world, I was the head judge. So I was involved with them, but not as a competitor.
Well, that's what I meant. In your competitive days, is there a reason you didn't go to the Weider magazines and the Weider camp, so to speak?
They worked my, there was no one in the camp that was a mentor to me. John Grimmick was my mentor. Clancy Ross was my mentor. Steve Leeds was one of my mentors. They had nothing to do with the IFBB. I wanted nothing to do with the IFBB. I wanted to be like the people I loved and my heroes.
Okay. I believe you beat one of those mentors in 56, didn't you?
Yeah, Clancy Ross, at the Mr. USA contest. And I came up, I apologized for winning the contest. He looked at me and said, Bill, youth must be served. That was his comment and walked away.
That's a class act.
Yes.
That's a class act. Okay. I remember, actually, you and I met at one of those pro shows that you were head judging back in 78 or 79. Mm-hmm. And I was always impressed by you. I mean, I'd seen a lot of competitors, seen a lot of shows, and you at, I guess, about 50 at that time, in your street clothes, still impressed me as one of the most massive people I'd ever seen. My hand disappeared in your hand when we shook hands.
Well, thank you, Will. That's nice. I was still getting exhibitions in my mid-50s and so on, so I was still getting on stage, and I can still hold my own at 55.
Your approach to stage exhibition was far different than most other pros. Most other pros that show up at a local contest, when we bring them in as a guest attraction, come out, do their posing routine, and leave. And you did something very, very different. Could you tell me about that?
Well, to begin with, Bill, I was the first person to choreograph my posing around music. Most people had music playing while they were posing, but they weren't choreographed to the music. I was the first bodybuilder to choreograph my posing to some type of a music theme. And then I also put in an old-time strongman act and bending hot water bottle, or excuse me, blowing up hot water bottles and bending spikes and breaking chains and things such as this to get attention, Bill, that the other strongmen and the old bodybuilders just weren't doing at that time.
Did you have the act, because I know it was a kind of a tribute to Eugene Sandow. I believe you wore the sandals and had the handlebar mustache, mm-hmm. and the whole costume. And
yes.
Did you have it as a choreographed to music, as a just a, like a whole theatrical performance?
I did. I had it choreographed to music with flickering lights and everything, just as if I were he back on stage in 1910, yes.
Wow. Is there any video of that around anywhere?
I think I have some, Bill. I think I have one or two, yes. I have some, I'm sure, somewhere in my archive someplace, but I haven't looked at them in years, Bill.
Well, that is something that should be up on YouTube for people to be able to really appreciate.
It was a lot of fun because, you know, if you stood there, rather than if his belly was pooched out, I'd pooch my belly out, and I would take stands that I normally wouldn't do because they posed differently then than they do now. But it was totally different, and their stances was off, and everything that I had trained myself not to do, to pose like Sandow, those are the things I had to do, which I normally would not do.
Which are probably things that most modern bodybuilders wouldn't do because they'd think, oh, I don't want to stand there with my stomach pushed out. I'm going to look fat.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You were trying to create the illusion, and apparently, from things I've read, you did a great job of it.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun. Now, that was fun, Bill. And I got standing ovations from that. It was accepted. People could understand it. They liked it.
Well, it's a something that the people in the audience that didn't care so much about bodybuilding could relate to.
Yes.
Something that promoters don't think of is you have friends and family of a contestant in the audience who came to see Joe, and they don't care about the other 30, 40, 50 people. So you have to do something to entertain them, and a strongman act like you're talking about is going to be entertaining to anyone, even if they care nothing about bodybuilding.
Deja vu type thing, yes.
Okay, so you got out of the gym industry in 71, 72, and when did you start your writing career?
I had actually started prior to getting out of the gym business. I think I have to look back. Leo Stern and I wrote several little booklets together, he and I. I mean, Building Bulk and Power and Big Arms and Big Chest and so on. And they were a little booklet we sold for $5. Those things sold by the thousands, and that's the first thing that Wheeler caught on to what we were doing, and then Schwarzenegger started writing books, Zane wrote books, Reg Park wrote books, everybody did, but they were following what Leo and I were doing at the time. We started that whole mess.
So you were the the start in modern bodybuilding. Because I know Sandow had courses and Farmer Burns had courses back in the 20s. But in modern day bodybuilding, you started the mail order business.
And then again, Bill, we emulated what those old time strong men did. I was hung up on that.
Well, like you said in a conversation we had previously, the body hasn't changed in thousands of years. So if people like Louis Cyr and Hackenschmidt and all these guys could do the tremendous feats of strength they did and build muscle the way they did without pharmaceuticals and without much knowledge of nutrition, it's got to still work today.
It does work today. In fact, people are trying to emulate it with all their kettlebells and all the strongman act. They're doing what people did back in 1910 and 1912 and thinking it's brand new. It's not. It's hundreds of years old.
Well, there seems to be a resurgence that modern-day strongmen are getting popular again. There are a handful of performing strongmen around. And
yes.
And that's an exciting thing. That's a fun thing. Can't remember who it is, but there's a guy that rolls up frying pans.
Bill Kazmaier.
Okay, well, I don't think Bill's still performing. But Bill,
I've seen Bill do that. He can do it and make it so easy. It's like rolling up a piece of tissue paper. Ah. But Kazmaier did that with ridiculous ease. And there again, so someone's emulating what he may have seen Bill Kazmaier do.
That makes sense. One of my employees, when I had the gym, got his master's at Auburn and worked in Kaz's gym in the 80s. So I got to meet him based on that, and we brought him down. He did a seminar here in Florida. Cost me more to feed him than it did to fly him down.
Well, I believe it. He's a nice guy, though, Bill. Bill's a sweet guy.
Oh, had a lot of fun with him. Okay, so you started the mail order business with you and Leo, and I was looking at your website, and I believe those are the very same booklets that you're still selling.
That's right. They're selling, and they're doing that. We have them printed, and we sell them all the time, Bill. It's amazing. Nothing's changed, Bill. Now it costs more for postage than it does for the booklet.
That's a sad thing. I know a lot of your other stuff has become a digital format. Have you ever thought about releasing those in digital form?
We are, and we're going to have to eventually, because I just can't go down and have it printing. At the age I am, I'm 84 years old, Bill, and I don't want to leave a mess bigger than I have now for everybody to have to clean up when I'm gone, Bill. So I'm trying to be careful and not go, write something and have it printed, have hundreds of thousands of dollars tied up in a printing, Bill, that just may not come back. I can't do that to the family, Bill.
Well, it's also much more practical, as you said.
No question.
With the cost of shipping them, it becomes prohibitive. And people want things right now, not send you the $7 or $8 or $10, whatever the booklets are these days, and wait for 2 to 3 weeks. They want to see it now. Click here, download the course.
Yeah, but most of our books that have sold well, they're all digital now, Bill.
That's the way you got to go. What possessed you to write that monster, that gigantic phone book, Keys to the Inner Universe?
My goal was to I wanted to start a home training course as personal training, get out of the gym business per se, so I didn't have to be around people all day long, but still run a gym in my home. So I was going to act as a personal trainer, Bill, and that was the guidebook for my personal training courses.
Did you ever offer a certification? Everybody else does.
No, I didn't offer certification, but I did write programs for people for years. And once I had the book started selling as well as it did, Bill, I was getting my mail for personal training in sacks, Bill. Not stacks, but in sacks of mail. There was no way in the world could I handle it. And Jim Morris, who was a very good friend of mine, said, Bill, forget the mail order business or personal training. Just sell the book as it is. And that's what we've done since then. And this book is still selling, and since 1978, it's done well. But it just got to the point where I just couldn't handle all the questions and answers that was being thrown at me. I couldn't do it. I was just one guy, and it wouldn't work.
That's when you got to start really jacking up the price to see who really wants the answers.
This is true.
Now, you had told me that you had actually posed for photographs for every one of the exercises, but in the final edition of the book, we have drawings.
Yes.
Could you explain? Why didn't you go with all the great photographs?
Simply because they wouldn't have been dated, Bill. I mentioned that to you before. If I had a pair of Adidas tennis shoes on and Adidas was no longer in business, the people look at the thing and say, this can't be worked because I had those pair of shoes back in 1978. This book is old-fashioned. I don't want to play with it because they won't think it's real. But you can't take a photograph or a drawing. You can't age a drawing, Bill. There's no age to a drawing, Bill.
It's going to be timeless.
That's exactly right.
So this was
and that's what I wanted the book to be.
Well, it is. It's I remember looking at it when it first came out, and I found it overwhelming. So many options, so many varieties. And it almost became like a game with my training partner and I looking through the book to see if we could find some. Ah, did he forget anything? Can we think of anything that's not in there? Or to try and find something we'd never heard of before. It was a fun book to just play with based on that.
Well, thank you. Well, what had happened, Bill, was that Nautilus had come out, Universal was out, and what happened, machines start taking the place of barbells and dumbbells, and barbell and dumbbell work became like Tiffany artwork. People forgot what to do with a barbell and a dumbbell. So this was like a piece of Tiffany artwork when it came to barbells and dumbbells because it showed you what to do. But even that is the way today. Now there's so many machines out there, and cardiovascular training is so popular today, very few people are training with barbells and dumbbells anymore, Bill.
Which is unfortunate. It is, and in reality, it's more effective in almost every case than all the machine work could possibly be.
There's no question, because each machine is trying to emulate one barbell or one dumbbell exercise, Bill. And there's thousands of barbell and dumbbell exercises you can do, but the machine will only allow you to do one of them.
And the point that most people don't recognize is that you have to go where that machine is built to go.
Okay, that's right. That's very true.
So if you've got some shoulder injuries, some elbow injuries, you're a little taller than the average person, it's not going to work.
No, it won't work as effectively.
Okay, so Keys to the Inner Universe was Beyond the Courses, the first major book, and then there are some other books that came out after that.
Yes, there's a book called Getting Stronger, and that Keys book was self-published, Bill. That was what we call a bastard book that has never had a publisher. My wife and I have published that book, and every Keys book that's been sent out there could probably sold 500,000 copies of that book. She and I have handled every one of those books at one time or another to get it to the individual. But then we wrote this other book called Getting Stronger, and we had a publisher for it, Random House. And that book sold 1,200,000 copies.
Well, Random House is not a minor publishing company, so obviously they saw something in you to take the chance and publish that book for you.
Well, and I also learned, Bill, it wasn't so much the publishing, but it's the distribution that counts. You can have any book published, but if you don't have a distribution basis for it, the book's going to sit on the shelf. That's all there is to it. It's the distribution that's important, not the publishing.
Okay. So did you at some point do, like, book signing tours and that kind of thing?
We did, yes. And I sold the rights to the book in Japanese. I sold the rights to the Keys book in German and all over the things. And I think some of those books are printed in 12 and 14 different languages, Bill.
I can't even imagine what it would cost to produce the Keys book now and to ship it.
Yeah. I don't even want to think about it, Bill. It's just a thing of the past.
It would be a tremendous cost. You'd probably have to charge in excess of $100 for a copy of it based on printing how many pages? My God. It was a
538 pages, if I'm not mistaken.
It's a huge book, but it was a great book.
Well, thank you.
And then somewhere in there, you decided to write your story. Beyond the Universe.
Yes.
You've had some interesting experiences in your life, and they've done a great deal of traveling, and for all the traveling you've done, is there anywhere you didn't get to that you would like to have gone?
No, not really where I didn't go, but some of the most interesting places. I've been to India, I've been to Africa, I've made trips really around the world, Bill. At one time, I was probably the most heavily traveled Mr. America winner that they've ever had, but I'm sure the kids today have outdone what I had did. Excuse me, had been, that's beautiful English, the language, excuse me, had been at the time. But there's no place I really wanted to go that I haven't gone, Bill. I've been very fortunate.
Where's your favorite place to visit?
I would probably think that my most favorite place to go was in Northern Ireland because I had so many friends over there.
Yeah. And did your wife travel with you or did you travel on your own?
No, she traveled with me. I made it a point. If she didn't go, Leo Stern went with me. I had someone by my side all the time, and we've been married, my wife and I, for 48 years, and we have never taken a vacation that wasn't a working vacation, Bill. Hmm.
One of the things that impresses me a great deal with a couple people in the sport is I've never seen Frank Zane without Christine, and I've never seen Lee Haney without Shirley.
He's smart. Both of them are smart people.
So when did you decide to switch to vegetarianism, which is a very, very unusual thing for a competitive bodybuilder?
I was 37 years old, and I was lying on a couch in my, I think it's, with my aches and pains in my joints and so on, and my cholesterol was sky high and so on, and I had to do something because what I was doing just wasn't working. I was getting to be an old man at 37 years old. And at the time, I worked for North American Rockwell as a consultant for the aerospace program. And I had the job for a sideline job other than my gym business for about 8 or 10 years. And there's a good friend of mine, there's a Dr. Morrison, who was, I worked under, and he took my some studies on me one time and found out that I was probably in the worst condition of anybody else trying to train for the astronaut program because of my cholesterol was so high and my triglycerides were sky high. And he said, if you don't get this thing squared away, you die. We're in trouble. Now, I looked at the guy like I thought he was nuts. But I had a very good friend who was a Seventh-day Adventist medical doctor. And I went to this Dr. Bailey, who was a good friend of mine, and he put me on the diet, and I stayed on the diet. It was a vegetarian diet, but I'd never gotten off of it.
And that was in 60?
I must have been 37. About 65, 66, somewhere around there, because I won 2 Mr. Universe contests on a vegetarian diet.
67 and 71.
Yeah, I'm still on it. We still follow that diet, Bill,
okay,
to this day.
Well, I suppose once it's like any other habit. Once you get used to it, it's easy enough to stick to.
Well, it gets to be such a goal, Bill, after all these years. It'd be like if I went back to do something now, Bill, that was contrary to what I've done. It's like you stop smoking, but then you start chewing tobacco. I don't want to do that. I got a good record going, and I don't want to break it.
I can understand that. So how did becoming a vegetarian, I know it was a lacto-ovo, you were still consuming dairy, still consuming eggs. How did your preparation for those last 2 Mr. Universe contests change based on your nutritional changes?
I just took in more supplement, a protein food supplements, which I fully overdosed on that stuff, Bill. But there again, what I felt that I had to have psychologically is what I did. I would sit down after a meal and I'd tell myself, now I've eaten this meal, here's what I want that food to do for me. And I'd sit down there and I'd pre-program myself as to what I wanted the food to do when it came to me as far as my bodybuilding career and what I was trying to accomplish was to do.
So you were willing that food, that protein, to turn into muscle.
That's exactly right, Bill.
The power of the mind.
Yeah.
Okay. So in 71, I think you were the most massive you've ever been, and you still were cut. You were never known to be shredded. That wasn't your thing. Your thing was nice proportions, tons of mass, and just very polished. How did you manage to carry that much mass at 41? I'm going to guess you were a good 50 pounds heavier than you were when you won your first Mr. America title.
I was 193 when I won the Mr. America title, and I was 242 at my last Mr. Universe title.
All right, so 49 pounds.
About 50 pounds, yeah. But then again, Bill, I had all those years of training, and I continued to improve bodybuilding for my training because I sit down and program myself. That's what I was going to do. Psychologically proved it.
And in your time, and when you prepared for a show, you prepared way in advance. You didn't decide 6 weeks out or even 3 months out.
No, years out. A year out, at least a year out, Bill. My whole life changed to specifically do what I was going to do at a certain time a year from then. That's what I had to do, because, and that's what I was there to do, just that. I was going to do the best I can with what I had to work with to do it. So I put my life on hold to do it.
Obviously, you did something right.
Well, thank you.
Would you mind playing a little name association?
No, I would be glad to.
Okay, I'll just throw names out, and you just throw whatever comes to your mind, good, bad, or indifferent. Bob Hoffman.
Narrow-minded, an egotist, would do anything for attention, and probably not the most ethical person that I've ever met.
And he played it so clean and made it like Joe was so unethical.
Yeah, well, you're right. They have an ongoing feud.
Okay, Dan Lurie.
Dan Lurie? Playing second fiddle to the leader and the Hoffman and so on. Dan always played second fiddle. The people who entered his physique contest were there, but probably would not have done well in the IFBB, probably would not have done real well in the NABA contest and so on. And so a lot of people, I don't like the word, but a lot of people use the word bottom feeders. I don't like that, but it was like that. That Joe could not get, Dan could not get the top to really stick with his contest unless they were at the top and starting to drop down.
Arnold.
In my life and your life, there's givers and there's takers. Arnold's the taker.
Franco.
Phil Colombo?
Yeah.
A real nice guy. I like him a lot and probably smarter than most of the bodybuilders at the time. Franco would analyze things and Franco could see through a lot of mistakes and stuff other people were making. And Franco was a nice guy. Still is a nice guy. I like Franco better than that whole crew. He was one of my favorites.
Vince Gironda.
A hard ass. Nice guy, but a hard ass. He was like a little Napoleon in his little teeny gym, and he ran it as if he were Napoleon, and you catered to what he had to say or out the door.
Okay. Larry Scott.
Real nice guy. I had a lot of respect for Larry. He had maybe too many people hanging around him that he didn't need to have around him. I mean, he had a constant group around him, praising him constantly when he was in the contest and so on. And I just didn't need that, but he did.
Okay, well, some people need lots and lots of support. Let's go with the Weeders. Let's start with Joe.
A person I like to talk to, but would not have business with.
Okay, would you like
anybody
to?
Anybody who worked with Joe on a business deal eventually got sued.
Okay. Ben?
Ben Weeder. A person who would pay anything to get his name in the public's eye. He was so prone towards publicity, regardless of what it took to get the publicity, that's what he would do.
Okay. You mentioned him as one of your heroes, one of your mentors, John Grimmick.
If I had anyone in the world I would have liked to have been more like, it would have been John Grimmick. He was my definite idol. I thought he was great on everything he did, and I can remember he had come to visit us one time at where we're living now, and he was staying at our house, and he had a photograph of him, that pedestal pose. Do you remember that, Bill, where he was leaning on a pedestal and posing?
Sure, he's sitting. I think he's got his elbow on his knee and his one leg straight,
yes,
flexing his bicep with his...
Pose. He said, he came to me and said, Bill, he said, this is the last of these pedal pose magnet photographs that I have. Would you like to have it if I signed it? And I said, I looked at him like I was talking to God. I said, you've got to be kidding me. And he signed it for me, and that was the biggest day of my life at the time. He, at our barn, working out in our barn where we all trained, giving me that photograph, Bill.
I'm sure you've still got it somewhere.
Oh, by far I do. It's on the wall, and it's, I don't like candles to it, but it's there.
You know, for somebody who's done everything you've done and has the respect that you have from everybody in the bodybuilding community, to say you wish to be more like anyone is just mind-boggling.
Oh, thank you.
Let's see. Dave Draper.
Dave Draper is a real nice guy. When he was a young kid as a bodybuilder, I think he was taken advantage of by the Weeders again. They had him to the point where they were trying to push him to do things that he didn't think he was physical or mentally capable of doing. And I remember when he first came to Los Angeles back from New Jersey, and he wanted me to help him with his posing. And so he came to our gym in L.A. at the time and started to pose. I said, Dave, you've got to do this, this, and this. And I remember he felt so bad. He actually hit himself in the face with his fist. Said, I'm so stupid, I can't pick this stuff up. I said, Dave, you've got to pick it up. It just takes practice. So Dave had a hard time getting to where Dave Draper is today.
Well, he's had more than his shares of ups and downs and turmoil in his life. There's a story I remember him writing in one of his books or just one of his columns somewhere that you had to lend him posing trunks for the Mr. America contest.
I did, but there again, he cherished those things, and he hadn't forgotten it, Bill. But he, too, is a tremendous writer, Bill. He's fabulous with the pen. He comes up with things that is on top of his head that's just unbelievable. I hope sometime if you haven't read some of his stuff, you're going to be able to do so, perhaps, because it's fabulous.
I actually, I'm subscribed to Dave's email list, and Laurie, his wife. I don't know if you've ever met Laurie, but she's a wonderful.
She's his savior, like you're just talking about all of us. She's his savior.
Oh, there's no question about that. There's no question about that. When she got with him in the mid to late 80s, he was as low as anyone
That's
could
right.
be, and
he'd be gone by now if it wasn't for her.
Yep. No, she's a wonderful lady. She sent me a couple of their books, and she sends me stuff all the time, and I feel guilty. Good. It's like, Laurie, let me pay for something, please. But
that's beautiful.
You're right. Dave's writing, as he's gotten older, he doesn't want to talk. Because he was the first person I approached to do an interview when we got this site going. And he said, I can't. I'm sorry. I don't do that anymore. Never doesn't respond to an email, but to speak to him.
He won't answer the phone either, Bill.
He doesn't talk.
No, he does not talk.
He doesn't talk. And when he did talk, he was a man of very few words and very simple, and he just, the way he expresses himself in writing is just amazing.
I agree.
Okay. Let's see. This should be an interesting one, because I know you can really expound upon this a lot more than just a one or two sentences. Arthur Jones and the history of Nautilus.
Arthur Jones was a true character, being one of the biggest characters the industry has ever shown, other than perhaps maybe Bernard McFadden and people such as he, but Arthur Jones was his own. Arthur Jones is Arthur Jones, period. He was a character. He was unbelievably eccentric, yes. My wife just was kind enough to say that when she's over here on a computer, but Arthur was too something to behold.
That's a very, very polite word, eccentric.
He and I had like a love-hate situation, Bill. We went on for a long time. He threatened to have me shot and had me out, people coming to burn our gym down and all types of stuff. It was crazy. Well, I have to tell you, when I got the Big Keys book out, I wanted to know what to do with it, Bill. I had 10,000 copies sitting in the warehouse, and I didn't know what to do with the book, the Big Keys book you were talking about, the interviews. So I went down to DeLand, Florida, to Arthur Jones to ask him about the book. And so I'd gotten there, and I was there for 2 or 3 days, and I said, Arthur, I said, you've been flying around people the last 2 or 3 days. You know I came here specifically to have you look at this book, which you just looked at and threw it on the table and never bothered looking at it again. And I said, I've come here for a specific reason. I said, what am I going to do with this book? He said, advertise, you silly bastard. Advertise. I got on the plane and came back to it, and that's exactly what I did. We advertised.
You were involved in some of the early development of Nautilus.
Yes.
I think, is it Bob Clark that like actually had the first cammed machines?
Yes, and it was in my gym in Sacramento. And Arthur Jones saw the off-center biceps machine as it came up, because he wanted me to be a part of his movies that he was doing, a movie called Voodoo Swamp. And he wanted me to be the monster in the movie. So he'd come to Sacramento to hire me to be in the movie. And he saw the cam machine in our gym in Sacramento.
Okay. So Bob Clark actually was probably the inventor of the off-centered cam.
Off-centered cam, yes.
And then Arthur went with it and
yes.
built an empire.
Yes.
Threatened to have you shot, huh?
I gave him a bad time. But the last time I saw him, I'd gone down to Florida for some reason or other, and a bunch of us decided to go see Arthur. I walked in the door, he looked at me, he said, I'll be damned. He said, it's been 47 years, 22 days, and 13 hours since we last saw each other. So he had this stuff down to a science, Bill, to the hour as to when he and I first met.
That's amazing. Do you think he was accurate, or do you think he just pulled a number out of the air when he said that?
I would think that he was probably quite accurate, but he threw everything. What he did, he would come up in the morning, he'd ask you a question, and it's something really profound. And if you didn't get any of impact out of you, he would change it till he wanted to. Every place he wanted to make some type of a statement that shocked everybody. So he'd practice in the morning before he went out on the street with everybody else. Practice on whoever was there.
Really?
He
wanted to make sure he always made an impression.
That's exactly right.
Well, he made a huge impression on the fitness industry and A lot of other people, apparently.
Yes.
What were your thoughts on women's bodybuilding when it started? Because it seemed like they didn't know which direction to go.
They still don't. Nothing's changed again, though. It's back to where it was at the beginning. The size cell, the femininity cell, they still don't know what they're talking about when it comes to female bodybuilding.
Yeah.
And the Miz contest might be with, but it's a hardcore bodybuilding like Ben Francis, most kids. They didn't have a clue what they were doing. The gals were fantastic, but the judging did not judge these people.
Go to a show, and the first show you'd go to, the muscular girl would win. The next show should be in fourth place, and the very feminine girl that looked like a gymnast would win. And
Yes. And
I think it's still that way. I guess that's why they've come up with all the fitness and figure and bikini and try and put a different category for each body type.
You're right. It hasn't changed.
Okay, well, you know, since we got to that, what are your thoughts on physique competitions? What they call a physique contest now. I don't even know if you're familiar, if you even watch or you've seen, but this, you know what I'm talking about with the long shorts and only judging the upper body. And
well, it's just a way to draw a crowd, Bill, for the promoter to make money, Bill, and it's out of hand, Bill. I wouldn't pay to go to a physique contest if I got a front row seat that cost me would not go.
Okay. I think it's interesting when you were a competitor. What you did was considered a physique contest. Bodybuilding was physique. Now physique is a whole different thing.
That's right. And they'll have women entering five different contests, Miss Bikini, Miss High Heels, Miss whatever. You see the same people off and on the stage all night long, Bill. It's ridiculous. It's silly. I couldn't sit through it.
It's, like you said, it's about making money.
What does Bill Pearl do with his life these days?
Well, we're probably as retired as we possibly can. I go to the office maybe once or twice a week, and my wife still takes care of the orders. But I have a collection of antique automobiles, Bill. I have about, I guess, about 20 or 22 old cars. And so I restore cars and play around for 4 or 5 hours each day on something. And I come into the room, but I still train every day or in the morning. And I'm still being busy.
Okay, you're still training. You're playing with antique cars. That sounds like a wonderful way to spend the day. Well, I could think of worse things to do. You're not sitting watching Wheel of Fortune, at least.
No, we watch judge programs, Bill.
I think we all do. My wife has to come home and watch Judge Judy.
Yeah, she's worse than Arthur Jones. They're in the same boat.
See, if this was 20 years ago, we might have Arthur Jones suing Bill Pearl on the Judge Judy show.
That's exactly right.
Now, that would be entertaining. I think we've pretty much covered everything. I mean, there's so much more we could get into, all your travel and all of your adventures, but I think we've pretty much covered all the highlights. Is there anything that you would like to say or to share with my listeners?
If I had anything to share with your listeners, it would be that if I had any advice for them, it would be to spend some quality time on themselves every day, Bill. Don't give the world all that you have. I'll meet a comment that I'll give the world 22, but I won't give it 24 hours. I want to spend some time on myself. And I think everybody should have the same attitude as I. And then it's a good thing when you see people, rather than frown, smile a little teeny bit. It's amazing what eye contact and a smile will do, Bill.
Doesn't hurt. Doesn't take that much effort. And for anyone that's interested in finding out more about Bill, there is his autobiography, Beyond the Universe, and Getting Stronger, Keys to the Inner Universe. And if you just want to learn some good basic training information, how to get bigger, how to get stronger, how to put on muscle the way the old timers did it, that still works, buy his courses. All of this is available at, and correct me if I get this wrong, but I believe it's BillPearlEnterprises.com.
Yes, Bill.
Okay. There will be a link on the show notes page directly to his website. And I want to thank you for taking the time to do this with me today, Bill.
You're a great guy, and I just wish you all the love in the world, and I admire what you're doing, and I admire you as an individual. With the handicaps that you've had and overcome, I can't do anything but just shake my head, and I wish you all the success in the world.
That's very kind of you to say.
Wow. Bill is a very special gentleman. I really enjoyed having the chance to talk to him. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. Now let's talk about next week's show. Next week, my guest is a gentleman named Mike Calvo, who many of you may know. Mike is very involved in CrossFit, and he is very excited about it, and he wants to share his experiences as a blind CrossFitter. So we had a very interesting conversation about the pros and cons and all the things that have made him so excited about CrossFit, and we're going to air that for you next week here on Real World Fitness. This has been your host, Bill, saying have a fantastic week, and we'll see you soon. Real World Fitness is a production of the Serotalk Podcast Network in cooperation with CosiabaFitness.com. All questions, comments, and feedback should be submitted to resources@serotalk.com. If you're listening on a mobile device, use your iBlink radio app to submit an iReport. Promotional consideration paid for by Audible.com.